When it comes to weight loss, no two people are the same. That's why Noom builds personalized plans based on your unique psychology and biology. Take Brittany. After years of unsustainable diets, Noom helped her lose 20 pounds and keep it off.
I was definitely in a yo-yo cycle for years of just losing weight, gaining weight, and it was exhausting.
And Stephanie. She's a former D1 athlete who knew she couldn't out-train her diet, and she lost 38 pounds.
My relationship to food before Noom was never consistent.
And Evan, he can't stand salads, but he still lost 50 pounds with Noom.
I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. Even through the pickiness, Noom taught me that building better habits builds a healthier lifestyle. I'm not doing this to get to a number. I'm doing this to feel better.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom users compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
It wasn't like I believed in myself or anything. I was just like, you're in charge. Something good happens, that'll be for you. And if something bad happens, that'll be on you. And that's how I'm just going through life, assuming that I will be in charge of every facet of my life.
What's up, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls around the world? I would like to welcome you back to the Real Talk with Zuby podcast. On today's episode, we have got on a stand-up comedian, a legend in the game, long, long running, one of the top podcasters in the world for over a decade, the one and only Adam Carolla. Welcome to the show, man.
Thanks for having me, Zuby.
No doubt. I say welcome, but I'm actually in your studio right now. We just wrapped up one of your shows. So firstly, thank you for taking the time out to do this.
Thanks for having me.
No doubt, man. Adam, I know you, millions of people around the world know you, but for those who are not familiar, please introduce yourself.
You want to go back?
Let's go back.
I was a sort of poor guy in the San Fernando Valley, sort of where we are now, North Hollywood, about 4 or 5 miles from here. Grew up kind of playing sports and being kind of physical. Wasn't a good student, wasn't even really a mediocre student, was a bad student. So I sort of did, everything I did was sort of physical, you know, and then, you know, I played sports in high school, did pretty good, left high school and just got a physical job, which was labor, construction labor, you know, on job sites, just picking up trash, digging ditches, you know, busting out stucco and stuff like that. Did that for a long time because I didn't have any other options. I wasn't that employable because I couldn't fill out the paperwork and the resumes and the and all that stuff. So I just sort of worked almost kind of underground, like a lot of construction. It's sort of, you don't have benefits, you don't have 401k, you don't have insurance, it's a lot of cash. You know, and you work like an undocumented worker, essentially, and you just go from job to job, you know. So, like, the guys waiting, the illegals at the Home Depot, waiting to jump in the back of the pickup truck and do whatever they're going to do for that day. That was essentially how I lived for, you know, a long period of time. I got a little bit older into my early 20s, probably young, 22, maybe 23. I just went, well, where's this end? You know, how's this going to work? Like, do you want to own a home? How could you own a home? You don't, there's no documentation of you working. You don't have a credit card. You couldn't buy things on time. You know, you couldn't buy a new car. You had to pay cash for a truck, you know, pay $900 for your truck. You know, it was a very kind of depressed financially and sort of morally world where you just couldn't book a flight on an airplane because you didn't have a credit card and you had no money set aside and you had no insurance. I had no life insurance. Forget about life. No medical. Mm-hmm. I didn't have car insurance. You know, you really was real hand to mouthy kind of, you know, make $8 an hour kind of work. And so I was like young and I was like, well, where's this going? How's this going to work out? And there are things I wanted, you know, I drove a truck. I wanted to drive a sports car, but I had to drive a truck, you know, and I wanted a house. but I had an apartment with three roommates, you know, and it was all, you know, pretty bad. And so I was like, well, what else can you, what do you think you can do? You know, and I eliminated doctor and lawyer and stuff like that just because I was a bad student. And I just, there's no way I wasn't going to go back to college or go to college and get some advanced degree or something. I was just a poor, poor student. Mm-hmm. So I was just like, well, I think I could do comedy. And I was always funny, you know, sort of naturally, but I wasn't getting paid to do it. I never did it. You know, I just, you know, crack up the guys on the job site, you know, kind of thing for me. So I was like, all right, well, you know, what does that mean? And I thought, well, I better start investigating doing this. Now, you know, as they say in show business, don't quit your day job. I didn't have any option about quitting my day job. That's how I existed, you know. So I, you know, drove a truck and swung a hammer and worked 50 hours a week on a job site. And then at night, I'd go do an open mic or I'd go take a groundlings class and an improv troupe or something. And I was just kind of working by day, and by night I was out trying to learn how to do comedy.
Mm. So that was all here in California?
Yep.
Born and raised, yeah?
Yep.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about your family background.
Poor.
Okay.
And kind of downtrodden, a little depressed, but not poor and depressed in a sort of white trash kind of way. My family was educated for the most part, had little problems with work ethics. They're really hard to categorize because they sound like alcoholics, but they weren't, you know. Okay. And they sound like drug abusers, but they weren't. And they sound like they would have been abusive parents, but they weren't. Mm. They were... My family was every man for themselves. They didn't look at kids as things to be taken care of. They just looked at it as a liability, you know. And they didn't have money. But they weren't, you know, they weren't poor. You wouldn't, nothing novels were made of. They were just boring poor.
Okay.
You know, but not destitute poor. We had a house. The house was my grandmother's house. She had a rental property, and she let us live in it, you know, one bedroom, one bath, you know, little 800-square-foot house in the valley. Mm. My dad worked a little bit as a substitute school teacher. My mom was welfare, food stamps, that kind of stuff, and living in her mom's house, sort of squatting her mom's extra house. And
so they were living, they were separate?
Yeah. Well, okay. He moved out, you know, so here's how much money my dad had. When they got divorced, when I was about eight or nine, I guess, they never got divorced because they didn't have any property. He didn't have any money. There was nothing to argue over or divide. He just moved out.
Gotcha.
And when he moved out, he initially stayed at his in-law's house in a spare office room. Like, he went to his in-laws, went to my mom's parents, stayed there. He didn't have enough money for an apartment or a hotel or anything like that. He just left, and then he sat there. And then me and my sister kind of split our time between my dad and my mom. But neither one of them really had much going on or money or things. And so my sister ran away when she was probably like 13 or something like that. And everyone just kind of spent time at other people's houses, you know, where they had food or games or something. You know, we just kind of drifted out.
Okay. Yeah. Because there's something you said really that fascinated me on the podcast we recorded earlier. I was on your show. And you said that from the age of about 9, you had worked out that no one was going to do anything for you or really help you to achieve success. And you specifically actually mentioned your family there. We were talking about the government and people relying on the state and stuff like that. But I think it's interesting to say that from such a young age, you had the realization that if you are going to go out there in this world and become successful, that is something that is dependent 100% on you. So can you talk around that a little bit more?
Yeah. My parents, while I would not call them bad people, were their entirety of their life was spent trying to save themselves, I guess, is take care of themselves, you know? And they didn't display any characteristics of taking care of anybody else, you know? And if they did, it would just be the barest of the minimum, you know? And so I got the impression that I just wasn't going to get things from these people, not stuff that I wanted. You know, I wanted a mini bike or a go-kart or something like that. It was never going to happen. I asked 200,000 times. They didn't even say no, by the way. It was like, you know, I want you to build a time machine. I'm going to go back and I'm going to kill Hitler, you know, and he just went, I'm not even going to say no. I'm just going to keep walking, you know. So I knew this group wasn't going to do anything for me. And financially, I knew it wasn't there. There wasn't going to be money. There was no college fund. There was nothing they were going to sign me up for, space camp or something like that. I wasn't going to get a musical tutor or something and learn to play the piano. I just saw what they did, and what they did was almost nothing, and I just knew there was going to be nothing for me. So it kind of made me think about it. I mean, it's a sad realization when you're young. You know, you have this sort of fantasy that, oh man, if some robber broke into this house, my dad would kill him. You know, how dare he come near my boy or whatever. There wasn't any. I knew they weren't going to do anything ever. So I intellectually understood it. It didn't feel good, but I kind of got into, what's my move going to be then? If these guys aren't going to do anything, and by the way, if they don't, then who? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, why would a stranger help you out, or even a school teacher? Or a coach or something of that nature. Who would do something for you? If your own parents aren't going to do anything for you, then who is? So then that gave me a sad, kind of empty and fearful. I was fearful because I wasn't old enough to get a job or protect myself or do the things that I would have needed to do that they weren't going to do. So I wouldn't say I had anxiety, but I was like, it's me and my mom sleeping in this dusty old house in North Hollywood. If somebody breaks into this house, she's not coming out of her room. Her door is locked. She locked her door at night. And if somebody comes in, I'm going to have to figure out a way to take this person on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for me, I got kind of resourceful. I would just go to other people's houses and eat dinner at their house and play with their kids' toys and stuff like that. And as I got a little older, I started sort of going, all right, you got to work. You're going to have to work at this, and you're going to have to figure this out. And it's probably going to take a while, but you're going to be the only. And it wasn't like I believed in myself or anything. I was just like, you're in charge. Something good happens, that'll be for you. And if something bad happens, that'll be on you. And that's how I'm just going through life, assuming that I will be in charge of every facet of my life.
Mm. Given that story, I think a lot of people, if in that position, would adopt the victim mentality and use that for the next several decades, if not their entire life, to justify their lack of achievement or success or even their own personal bad behavior. What do you think it is that prevented that from happening with you? A lot of people would tell that same story about a childhood, perhaps, you know, more severe, perhaps less severe, whatever, but they will then take that into their 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and again, that becomes their permanent alibi. So, how did you avoid that?
Well, I probably had the right to play the card, but it wasn't pragmatic for me. It was sort of like, I could sit here and cry on my bed for eternity, but no one was ever going to come into the room and soothe me. I would just be on this bed crying, wasting salt in tears, you know? And so for me, it was like, yeah, I know people that are, I was exposed to people that were successful, you know, kids whose parents were successful and had more money. And, you know, when I would play peewee football, I would see some of these other kids' dads pick them up in nice cars and take them out to restaurants and things of that nature. And I would go, well, I wish that were my dad, you know, but it wasn't my dad. And I wasn't going to get anything through assuming that role. I couldn't find a tangible path. Mm. You know, if somebody said, look, if you pout long enough and hard enough, you're going to get a Ferrari. I would have said, okay, I'll give it a try at least.
Yeah.
But in my estimation, nothing came out the other end.
Mm.
And so it didn't seem practical to me. It seemed like you want that Ferrari, right? Yeah. Well, you can pout and you'll never get the Ferrari, or you can go bust your hump and you'll probably not get the Ferrari, but maybe there's a chance you get the Ferrari. And that was sort of, that was my mentality.
Mm. So very pragmatic from a young age, essentially.
Well, you had to be pragmatic if you came from my family, because there wasn't any pie in the sky anywhere. There wasn't any delusions of any kind of grandeur, or there wasn't anything. I mean, it was not like, you're going to go, you know, my son's going to be the best doctor in the land, or it was nothing. It was just, everything sucks. You get out of the house.
Mm.
It's hot. No air conditioning. No heat. You know, just go do something. And it didn't from a pragmatic standpoint, make sense to me to be a victim. I mean, spiritually, I never liked, just in general, you know, I always had some sort of integrity or something that was just sort of in me that everyone thinks they have, you know. But I bring receipts. Okay. I bring receipts. The best trophy that this'll kind of encompass many things that have shaped me, or you'll get some insight into who I am. When I was, must have been about 10 years old. The only thing I did well is I played football well, American football well, and that's all I had. And so I loved it, and I clung onto it with like both hands, you know, and it became a lifesaver for me. But it's all I had. Everything in my family and school and grades and everything was bad except for football. So, and I was good at it, and so I liked it. And I thought about it all the time and stuff like that. And then one day on Christmas time, the season ended, I didn't win any awards. And one time around Christmas, shortly after the season ended, I was at my grandparents' house, lived also in the neighborhood, and there was like a knock on the door. And it was one of my football coaches. And he was there with a box. And it was a kind of a flat white box. It was kind of a box you'd put a nice dress shirt in or something. And he said, I have this for Adam. And I got excited because I thought inside of the box was an East Valley Trojans windbreaker. I could never afford. The other kids would get the windbreaker with the patch on it,
yeah,
and their name, you know, would be embroidered into it and stuff, and they'd sew a little football on it and sew a little star on it. I was like, oh, one of those windbreakers. But they were probably $11, you know. There's no way I was getting one of those windbreakers. So when he presented this box to me, I was like, oh, my God, I'm getting a windbreaker. And when I opened the box, was a trophy. And I was initially very disappointed. I was disappointed in general. I wanted the windbreaker over the trophy. Now, that's insane thought, number one, because anybody can go pay $13 and get a windbreaker. But the trophy, that means something, you know. But for me, I wanted the windbreaker. So I saw it was a trophy. And the trophy read best all-around offensive and defensive player. And I still wanted the windbreaker, but I was happy to have this surprise.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the few sort of nice surprises. My childhood was not a happy surprise, but this was. And then I realized they made me that trophy special later on because they realized that everybody voted for the kid in, you know, who's going to be the most valuable offensive player and the most valuable defensive player. And they knew, because of my spelling and my writing and how atrocious it was, they knew that I didn't vote for myself.
Okay.
I voted for this kid and that kid. Because even when I was 10, I didn't think it was appropriate to vote for yourself.
Mm.
But all the other kids voted for themselves, right? So I lost by a vote, but it's because I didn't vote for myself.
So everybody else voted for themselves? Or
that's what the coaches surmise. Okay. Well, that's what a 10-year-old would do.
Yeah,
you'd go,
funny.
Well, also, the 10-year-old who voted for themselves. No, I mean, they'd say, like, best defensive lineman.
Mm.
Okay, well, there's only five guys who play defensive line. So everyone would vote for that part. But all the five guys would vote for themselves.
Gotcha.
I didn't.
Okay.
And I didn't on the other side of the ball either. So they figured out that I lost by a vote on offense and defense, and I didn't vote for myself. And I had low self-esteem. Like, I just didn't think – I thought I'd get into trouble or somebody would find out and think badly, poorly of me or something. So – I didn't vote for myself, and I was disappointed that this trophy that was the best defensive and offensive player was not a $12 windbreaker. And that's where my head was at, and that's how I sort of went through life.
That's funny. So you got into comedy in your early 20s. Talk me through that journey.
I was 20 in my 22, whatever, and I said, well, maybe you could do comedy. But you don't have any training in comedy, and you don't have any official background in comedy. You've never been on stage before. You don't know anything about this, other than you're funny, which is good, but you have no experience. So I said, well, let's try to be realistic about this. You're not going to have any success early, and nor should you want success early because you don't know what you're doing. So why would you want success early? I don't think you'd be able to handle it, you know, or figure it out or maintain it, you know? So I said, all right, look, you don't really need to do anything in your 20s per se. It'd be nice, but I said, look, by the time you're 30, you have to do something in that's creative. And I did not specify on stage or on camera or behind a microphone, which I really didn't think of myself as. I thought of myself as a – I really thought of myself as you – I work for some company that writes funny greeting cards.
Okay.
And I just sit in a room with five other guys and I go, how about this one? And then someone would have to type it and make the card, you know. But – that's who I thought I was going to be. And, you know, if I could make 40 grand a year doing that and have insurance and a couple of sick days a year, I thought, well, that's a hell of a lot better than being on a construction site digging ditches all day, you know. So that was it. By the time you're 30, now, you know, maybe you'll be on stage. Maybe you'll be in radio. Oh, maybe you'll be on TV. I don't know. But those aren't the rules. The rules are doing something other than moving cinder blocks and climbing up on roofs and underneath apartment buildings and stuff like that. Something with your mind and something creative and maybe something that uses your sense of humor rather than your back.
Mm.
And you have until you're 30, so go train because, you know, again, if you're not successful at 27, it's not the end of the world, but if you're 37 and you're not, that's not good. So get going and you got time.
And that was just something that you told yourself that didn't come from anyone else. Yeah.
No, that was alone. You know, none of this was going to come from anybody else.
Yeah.
I that's, nobody thought I was funny or said I was funny. No. Many people thought I was funny, but yeah. Nobody said you should do comedy. Mm-hmm. Now, like, in terms of people do that, they go, oh, what'd your family think when you got into comedy or whatever? I said, I didn't. First off, I didn't tell them.
Yeah.
Number two, they wouldn't care. And number three, I could ask a homeless guy, what do you think about me getting into comedy? It'd be the same answer. Like, why are you telling me? Yeah. Do whatever you want. Just don't do it in the house. Do it on your own.
Yeah.
So I did not get encouraged. No one steered me anywhere. I just said, it's time to go out into that world and see if you can find your way.
Okay. And how did that go? So what was the plan? You just were attending open mics, or were you putting on your own shows? What point did you feel like you were making some type of break or achieving some type of success?
I started in, improv troupes and collaborating and writing sketches and working out improvisational techniques at the Groundlings and later on Acme Theater, which I helped to form way back in the day. And, the feedback I was getting is that I was pretty funny but kind of green, and, I didn't really know. Most of the people I was working with had experience in drama and productions and plays and schools and theater majors and stuff like that. And I was just sort of very blue collar and very raw, but I was funny, but I didn't know the difference between stage right and stage left or upstage and downstage. I didn't know what any of these, I didn't know, sometimes they say, oh, we're going to do an improv, or we're going to do it all Shakespearean style. All right, here we go. And I'd be like, Shakespearean.
What does that mean?
I don't even know what. I couldn't do any of that. These people could do it. Mm-hmm. They could do full improv in full Shakespearean because they trained and they read and they did the plays, So I was a little fish out of water, but I worked at it, and I just worked for free, and I never got paid, and I never had any success. I had little bits and pieces. I taught comedy traffic school because I thought it'd be a good experience.
Comedy traffic school.
Out here, when I say out here, I guess I mean the United States, they have traffic school taught by comedians.
Okay.
And it's like 8 hours worth of class. If you get a speeding ticket, you got to go to traffic school.
Oh, okay.
And I'd do 8 hours of that. But as a comedian, they wanted you to be funny because they pay an extra like $4 to go to the comedy. Now,
Total.
The ticket, if you signed up for traffic school back then, you could go to Sears traffic school for like $19, or you could go to Let Us Amuse You, which was my traffic school, for like $24.
Okay.
But you'd get a comedian.
Interesting.
Yeah. So I thought, well, that'd be a good experience for me, be up on my feet for 8 hours trying to make people laugh.
No doubt. So at what point did you start to feel like you were achieving success?
I never really was achieving any success. I'm not sure how you measure success.
Yeah. I think it's somewhat subjective. Mm-hmm. I think there's a point in your life. I don't know. I guess I could say with myself from around 2021, I felt like, okay, I feel like I'm successful from all the efforts I've been putting in over the past 15 plus years. I'd say that would be the year where I was like, okay, cool. Like, by various measures and certain aspirations, I've achieved a level of success, nowhere near the peak of it or what I'm capable of doing that I'm going to do in the future. But I'd say that was like a turning point.
Well, so I never had any financial success in comedy at that point. I taught traffic school. I got, $80 for an 8 hour weekend or $85 or something like that. I kind of looked at that as being paid, to do comedy, even though, it really wasn't, but I still was proud that I wasn't swinging a hammer to get paid. I'd only gotten paid to move boxes and lift things and stuff like that. So, to get paid for my mind was something that was important and I was proud of, because it never happened to me before. Because my I grew up with work is work.
Yes.
Like you work, you don't sit and you couldn't sit and be at work. You'd have to be up on your feet doing stuff. And so, you know, comedy traffic school, and I got paid a little bit, and I get an occasional gig doing something, somebody's birthday party or something somehow. But no, there was no money and there was no success, but there was a lot of training. Mm-hmm. And a lot of repetition and a lot of understood my way around an improv stage and troupe and experience, gotcha. You know. And then at a certain point, I was starting to kind of come to grips with the fact that maybe show business was not going to be a way I made my living. So I started thinking about other interests and passions that I had, and one of them was boxing.
Okay.
And so I started to see these places open up that have these white collar boxing, where like they taught boxing to attorneys and professionals, you know, not fighters.
Gotcha.
And so I was like, God, I feel like that'd be a fun job to have, because again, I get to work with people and do stuff I like, and I was good at it. You know, I was good at instructing and stuff.
Okay, do you mean as a coach?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I was. You know, I was a decent boxer. I was probably a better coach because I could explain how to do it and use some metaphors and things like that. So, I found my way to a place where guy went to college with a friend. He opened this place called Bodies in Motion and so on and so forth. And I kind of went in there and I went, hey, you know, I'm a friend of your friend Robbie's from college. And I want to teach, you know. And he said, well, we only hire champions or ex-champions, you know, so now, you know. And I was like, I think I'd be good at this, you know? And he's like, I don't really care if you're good at it. I got to say such and such champion teaches the class, because I let Joe Blow teach the boxing class, you know? So I was like, okay. And as I was talking to him, I was looking behind him, and he had like heavy bags laying on the floor and a speed bag station and stuff on the wall, but on the floor, stuff that needed to be mounted and like hung up and stuff like that. I was like looking around, and while he was kind of shooing me out the front door, I just sort of stopped and I said, you look like you could use some help around here, hanging up bags and hanging up speed bags and fixing some stuff around here in this gym. And he's like, yeah. I was like, well, I'm a carpenter and I can do all that.
Mm.
And he's like, oh, you are, huh? And I said, yeah, I am. And he said, well, let me show you some stuff I need worked on around here. I said, okay, well, see, now we're getting somewhere, because I'll tell you what time you close? He said, 10 at night. I said, what time you open? 6 in the morning. I said, okay, I'll be here from 10:01 to 5:59. I'll work through the night. I'll hang this stuff. I'll fix this stuff. And I'll charge you $10 an hour flat. That's it. Just give me 10 bucks an hour. I'll do it. You have to give me a chance to teach boxing. You don't have to hire me to teach boxing, but you have to give me a chance to show you what I can do. And he said, yeah, okay, fine. Go hang all this stuff, and then I'll give you a chance, you know? So I hung all the stuff, and he gave me a chance. And a few months later, he said, I'm opening a place in Pasadena. You go over there and build it out. And, you can teach, you know, the morning classes or whatever it was. And so I was teaching the morning class, you know, 6:30 to 7:30, whatever. And then I was going off and swinging a hammer for a living for the rest.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was like, well, it's not show business, but you're kind of on your feet. You're having a good time with these people. You're at least doing what you want to do part of the time. And, you know, my business, I was doing more finish work and less digging ditches and stuff like that. You know, I was doing carpentry now, and I was like, well, maybe this is about it, you know?
How old were you at this time?
I was like 28, okay. 29. I was coming up on that 30 number that I'd promised. And as I was coming up on that 30 number, it wasn't looking good. I really hadn't gotten anywhere, but I trained a lot. I met a lot of people and, you know, maybe had a good time, but I just it didn't seem like it was going to be in the cards from a career standpoint. And as I was driving my truck over the Laurel Canyon into the city, maybe a month away from my 30th birthday, I tuned into the morning radio station, and they're doing a bit, and the bit was the sports guy was going to box Michael, the maintenance man, and they were going to do this thing. They're going to do a morning zoo type of thing. We're going to have a boxing match, you know, between these two guys. And they were saying, you know, okay, you know, we're going to need equipment and trainers and a venue. And if you own a venue or you're a trainer, we need ring girls, you know. And I'm driving my truck going, oh, wow, whoa, I'm a trainer. And radio, I love radio. I could see, maybe I could train somebody and see the inside of a radio station, you know. And so when I got to the house, I didn't have a cell phone, but when I got to the house I was working on, I asked if I could use the phone. And I called the radio station, and I kept calling the radio station. They never returned my calls, and I kept hearing about them talk about this boxing match the next day, and I kept calling, you know. And eventually I went down to the radio station, but the building was locked, and I couldn't get into the building. It was a commercial building in Burbank. And then they said, well, the building opens at 7, you know. And I go, well, I got to teach a 6:30 boxing class or whatever. So then the following day I got someone to cover my class for me, and I went back to the radio station, the building, the commercial building, and they're on the 9th floor. And I went up to K-Rock to the 9th floor, and the suite is closed. The business hours are 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Mm-hmm. So now I found myself standing in the hallway by the elevators going, damn, what do I do? They're not going to open this place for another couple hours. But I knew the morning crew was in there. They're in the building, but I can't get into the suite, you know. Even if it was open, the receptionist not going to let me walk into the radio station, the, you know, studio. So I'm like standing out there in the hall, kind of trying to figure out what I want to do. And a guy comes up the elevator, and he's got like a key card or something. He's going to the back door with the key card. He works there in some capacity, or he's, you know, filling the vending machine or something. Mm. I don't know what he's doing, but he's heading back there. So I start walking with him. And I said, hey, you going into the studio? You going into the station? Yeah. I said, there's a boxing coach standing out in the hall. That'll be me. I'll just be waiting out here by the elevator. So can you go in, tell him there's a boxing coach by the elevator just waiting here? I said, I didn't even know if he said okay. He just sort of like waved his hand or something. He went in. And then I just stood by the elevators for half an hour. Mm-hmm. So I assumed people were on the air in between. Wasn't a priority. And then at some point, some guy comes walking down the hall, some young guy. And that's Jimmy, the sports guy, one of the guys. He comes walking down the hall, and he just walks up and he goes, you the boxing coach? And I said, yep. And he said, okay. And I said, okay. And he goes, you want to start?
Yeah.
I said, yeah. When do you want to start? He said, you want to start today? I said, let's start today. I'll give you the directions to the Pasadena Bodies in Motion I'm teaching at, and I'll start teaching you to box. Mm. He said, all right, I'll see you at noon. And he went back into the K-Rock. And that person was Jimmy Kimmel.
Okay. Okay.
But he was 26, and he didn't have a lot of juice at the radio station at the time either. He was doing the sports. So I knew that he could help me get into radio or get into something. Radio. Mm-hmm. I want to get into radio. And I knew I had to convince him I was funny.
Yes.
But I couldn't really come on too strong because I was his boxing coach. Mm. I didn't want to think I was just there trying to get my resume under the door, you know. So I stuck to boxing at the beginning. But I worked in some comedy, you know, along the way. And then kind of at some point, he was just like, man, you're funny, you know. And I was like, good, good. And so he said, what do you got? You got any tape or any? What do you do? And I go, well, you know, I did this and I do that, but I don't really have. But I had a tape, a VHS tape of me doing some public access show at the Eagle Rock public access station or something. I said, that's all I got is this. It was crude, you know?
Yeah.
And he took a look at it and he was like, you know, it's crude and it's raw and it's whatever, but I see something in you. I can tell you could do this and I could see that in mm-hmm. you know? And then, you know, we had the boxing match and he lost, and that was on about 3 weeks down the road. And so now I'm about to turn 30 and I say to Jimmy, what can I do? What can you help me? How could I be part of this radio station, of this morning show? Mm-hmm. You know, what could I do? And he said, well, what do you do? And I said, well, I crack wise. I make everyone funnier. I sit and get in between people and keep the conversation going, you know? And he said, well, they don't need that, because the Kevin and Bean, the morning show, that's what they do. So mm-hmm. they need you to do. I said, well, I don't know what else to do, you know? And he said, well, you want to come up with a character. If you come up with a character, I could get you on. I'm not going to tell them you're the boxing coach, because if I tell them you're the boxing coach, then they're going to go, come on, give me a break.
Yeah.
I'm just going to tell them there's this guy, you know, I think he's funny. Let him just call in on Monday. And he said, you know, they're probably not going to like whatever it is you're going to do, and that'll be about it with that. But, you know, if it works, maybe you call in the next Monday. And there's no pay or anything, but you could get on the radio. Mm-hmm. So I had the weekend to come up with this character, and I immediately fell back on all my Groundlings improv training.
Yes.
And I sculpted this character with a whole life and motivation. Why is he calling, and who is he, and where does he work, and what's his name, and, you know, what's his family like? And I constructed this whole thing just 'cause I had so much experience by then building characters. And I called in and it worked. And, you know, Jimmy didn't have much pull at that point, because he wasn't too high up mm-hmm. over there. But he was like, yeah, they liked it. They thought it was good, you know, like, you know, try again the following Monday. We'll see what we can do. And I was like, oh, thank you, man. Thank you. You know, and I called back a few times. I turned 30. I still wasn't getting paid, but I was doing something now. Yes. I was part of something. And then the character just blew up.
Okay.
And became a sensation.
What was the name of the character?
Mr. Burcham.
Okay.
The woodshop teacher. And I got signed by William Morris, because they listened to the morning show and they loved Mr. Burcham, and everyone loved Mr. Burcham. And next thing you know, I was hosting Loveline, the syndicated radio show, and, you know, making hundreds of thousands of dollars, and it just all blew up like immediately. So right after I met Jimmy and I got on to radio, I went from destitute, no insurance. Oh, you know, the first thing I had to do was pay the IRS off money I owed them, you know. I mean, I had nothing.
Yeah.
To buying a house in the Hollywood Hills like a year and a half later.
Wow.
It was crazy.
What was that like?
I was up for it.
Yeah.
I was like, I bought myself a Nissan Maxima with leather interior, you know? Okay. And I was like having a credit card and an insurance and living in a nice home in a nice neighborhood mm-hmm. and driving a car that wasn't a truck, you know? I mean, I drove trucks when trucks were trucks, you sure. know, not nice, you know, and not sweating through my shirt every day for work and writing jokes and hanging out with Jimmy and eating lunch, you know, at a nice restaurant and stuff. Like, I was like, oh, man, this is what I've always wanted. This is what I wanted to do, mm-hmm. you know, and this is why I did this. I wanted to buy a nice car and enjoy going to lunch and sitting indoors eating lunch, not outside on a drywall pile, you know? And so, like, it was real nice, but I was also like, I got to make up for lost time. Like, I've been spinning my wheels for 10 years doing nothing, you know. So, Jimmy, let's get going. Let's do some shows. Let's figure some stuff out. Let's go, you know. Let's try to get this horsepower down to the rear wheels, you know. Like, I want to, now I don't want to survive anymore. I want to thrive,
yes,
you know, at this point. So, so Jimmy and I started, you know, going, all right, let's collaborate. Let's work on stuff together.
Mm-hmm. And what was it that you guys created?
We created The Man Show, and then we created Crank Yankers.
Okay.
And then we created some other shows as well. But those were kind of the notable shows.
I've heard of The Man Show, but I guess it was before my time, certainly before I was aware of all the things that you were doing. So when was that started, and what was the basis of the show?
We wanted to do a show where we could work together and do whatever we wanted to do.
Okay.
So, I mean, we called it The Man Show just to give it, you know, a title and have some structure to it. But it's really like just a show that you would do with your best friend if you could dream of a fantasy show mm-hmm. that you could do. And all we want to do is do funny stuff. And started in probably the late 90s and became a big hit and a sensation pretty quickly. But it was really just because we were enjoying working with each other mm-hmm. a lot and working with the people we wanted to work with too. That's dope.
And was it that just to be clear, was that was a radio, it was a radio show or
no,
TV show. Okay. On what network?
It ended up being on Comedy Central. It was okay. For another network first. And then I did Loveline, the radio show. I did that on MTV every night for an hour. So I was on MTV back when MTV was MTV. Mm. You know, it was a big deal to be on MTV.
How much of all these worlds changed since you got into it all? So you've done radio, comedy, television. I mean, talking about things happening back in the 80s or the 90s, these industries and the Overton window within them was, I imagine, in a very different place to where it is now. So what have you yourself seen over the course of those few decades? How have you seen it change?
Well, you know, different entities don't have a reign that is endless. You know, mm. you see MTV go from one of the biggest, most influential platforms around to sort of, well, I don't know what number it is on my cable anymore. You know what I mean? Like, kids don't watch MTV. Yeah. When I was, you know, a certain age, everyone watched MTV. So if you were on MTV, then you were a star, mm-hmm. you know? And if you were on K-Rock Radio, you were a star. Mm. And maybe even Comedy Central to a certain degree. And so these platforms, you know, it's like Sports Illustrated was huge and now Sports Illustrated isn't huge, you know? And I think the challenge, whether it's an entity like Sports Illustrated or just a person like Jimmy Kimmel or Adam Carolla, is how do we do this for 30 years? Mm. How do you do it for 50 years? You know, how do you keep this brand sort of going and moving forward? You know, it's like back in the day, you'd do an appearance on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson and your world would explode, yeah. You know. Now you don't.
Yes. Do you think that's overall better now? That people have, it's more democratic in a way, that people can go out there, whether you're a comedian, a musician, any type of entertainer or even entrepreneur, you can go out and create your own lane and your own platform. It could be a podcast, it could be a YouTube channel, it could be social media, whatever it is. Do you think that it's now, rather than having those sort of specific gatekeepers, do you think that it's now a better time to be an entertainer?
Well, I think it's more, I mean, it a better time sort of depends who you're asking, because mm-hmm. the guys who were on The Tonight Show that were marginally talented but getting all all the sitcoms and things like might disagree with me. Yeah. I would say it's probably more merit-based now than ever, although people always bring up, oh, this guy's got 7 billion viewers and he's a talentless hack or something. It's like, yeah, I know, but get hold of me in 5 years and let's see how this person's doing. You know, it's I think it's better if you're good. I may have had a little more success at an earlier age if it was if some of these corridors were open to people like me. Mm-hmm. I didn't know I would have started doing a podcast when I was 17 if there was such a thing. I all we had was radio, and I didn't know anybody in radio, and neither did anyone in my family. So, you know, I think it's more saturated now.
Okay.
But it's I think it is more democratic. I don't think there are barriers. You know, I mean, it used to be, well, if you're a woman, you weren't going to have a hard time doing comedy because no one wants to hear a woman do comedy. You know, all that stuff's kind of gone away. But now everyone's kind of facing the reality of you're going to have to do this on your own, or you're going to have to figure out a way to do it for yourself. And the consumer will decide whether they want to hear your voice or not. And now it's kind of sobering because I think that in the past, there's a lot of sayings in Hollywood. It's who you know. It's who you know. It's luck. It's a combination of luck and who you know, which back to the victim mentality, you just go ahead and pawn off your lack of success on some happenstance or not knowing the right people. So it was always about knowing the right people, who you know and stuff. And that's always going to be a characteristic of almost any business. There is going to be an element of networking and who you know and, you know, coming out and taking unpopular stances about COVID and things like that are not going to help push your career along. I'm here to tell you. Mm. But there isn't a bunch of gatekeepers between you and the audience.
Yes.
Now,
I've heard a lot of comedians complain about the excesses of political correctness, or the term that people now generally sort of call wokeness, and how it has affected comedy and comedians. What is your position on that? Do you agree? Do you think it's a little bit overblown? What are your general thoughts on that as you've been in it for decades?
It's something people who have something to protect tend to try to protect it. And comedians that are popular and well-known tend, I think, during this period to probably be less edgy because they're trying to sort of protect a brand. Mm. And there's a lot of endorsements and, you know, I mean, I ran into a pretty famous comedian who I won't out him by saying his name, but he does a lot of endorsements. And I just in the green room of the Improv with him, and we're just sitting there alone. And he just looked at me and he went, "Must be nice saying whatever you want."
Mm.
And I said, "Yeah, I do enjoy saying whatever I want." And then I realized by implication, he wasn't saying what he wanted, but he was getting paid. You know, and there's a strong element of that. It then also creates a bunch of people at the lower level who don't have anything to lose, who are now rising up fast because they're saying what the rich guys should have been saying, but they're too busy protecting their lead. Mm. You know what I mean? So all of a sudden, there's these guys that have come out of nowhere in the last few years that are like, oh, this guy's a big name now. We hadn't even heard of him before because he's saying the stuff they're unwilling to say.
That's so interesting. So they've essentially, by them stifling themselves and self-censoring and essentially appeasing the powers that be so much, they've created an open lane for young up-and-comers who are willing to take those risks and be a bit more edgy to actually find fame and success.
Yeah, in a way, just like they created Tucker Carlson or Joe Rogan or Ben Shapiro. You know, you guys started clamping down in this sort of legacy media world and stuff, and you created these guys
Yes.
that said, you're going to find, you know, you run an oppressive regime and you're going to create some rebels, you know what I mean? And others are not going to go along with it, and some are just going to get shot. But you will create these characters. You know, the French underground didn't exist because it didn't need to exist, and then Germans and Nazis occupied France, and then a French underground existed. You know, that was created because of this other thing. So they are creating sort of simultaneously while trying to police. That's the phenomenon I feel like we're living in right now.
Yeah. Adam, what are your thoughts on where the USA is and the direction that it's heading? This is something that, man, there's so many different perspectives on it. There's the people who say that, you know, the country is just falling and they're seeing all the problems and very concerned about its trajectory, infringements on freedom, the border, whatever the case may be, social, cultural, political. And then there are other people who have a much more optimistic worldview and who think that things are continuing to incline. What's your overall take? You can answer this at whatever depth you want to go into, about just the direction you see the USA going in.
I think we're going to kind of splinter off into what I refer to as safe spaces and octagons.
Okay.
And the places. So I've lived in California my whole life. Mm. And nobody my whole life would ever even flirt with the notion of leaving California. People showed up in California. You don't leave California. And many, many people I speak to have left and are planning on leaving. Now, they don't really want to, but I just got back from Florida and I met a bunch of ex-California patriots who just left, you know. And so they set, so they're creating a group, you know. So you're going, all right, California is going to get, you know, higher tax burdens and higher regulation burdens and more things that I disagree with. Now, that doesn't mean I'm right. I am, but well, we're right, yeah. but I disagree with it. Mm-hmm. I do not want the government creating a third aisle for the transgender community in the kids' Target. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
For their toys. I don't want it. I don't want tampon dispensers in the boys' room at the junior high. You know, I disagree with that, right? And I disagree with the regulation, and I disagree with a lot of the taxation, and I disagree with a lot of it.
Yeah.
So eventually I'm going to end up in Florida with the people, with the other people that disagree.
I was about to ask, what is it that keeps you in California? I know so many people, many of them very prominent individuals, who have left California over the last 4 years. So what is it that keeps you here, or what is it that would push
you? Well, I have twins, and they'll be graduating high school in 4 or 5 months. And
okay.
I always say, I say this answer all the time. I realize it's a joke, but people always say to me, they go, when are you going to leave California? And I go, I will be attending my kids' high school graduation in a U-Haul.
Oh, wow. Okay.
That's when I leave.
And you're looking at Florida?
Florida, Nevada, Texas. Okay. That's the other sad thing, is anywhere.
Yes.
But not California. And so what's going to happen is we're going to create safe spaces. And if you want to trans your kid or get a free abortion or you love illegals or whatever it is, and you want big states telling you what to do, and if another pandemic rolls around, you'll have someone to cut down the volleyball nets at the beach, if that's something that's attractive to you, and it is to a lot of Californians, they like being ruled.
Yes.
You know, Newsom won by a landslide. If that's what's attractive to you, then you'll no longer be able to live in that environment. California was very different 20 years ago. It was just live and let live. No one cared about politics. No one knew. We were going to the beach and having a good time.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Now it became this. Then you are going to move to one of these other places where you agree with what they agree with.
Mm-hmm.
And my prediction is eventually the blue cities and states, the same The same with announcing, you know, your sanctuary city, and then we start dropping the migrants off on your doorstep, and now you start freaking out, and you need someone to bail you out. I think these blue cities and blue states are then going to need to be saved by the red states who are gainfully employed, because your guys' policies are so god-awful that they're not tenable.
Yes.
So it's going on in Texas right now. You know, you have the federal government saying, take down the barbed wire and let the illegals in. And Texas is going, screw that.
Yeah.
This is our land. And we don't want these people in here. So we're going to take it upon ourselves. So it's going to be, that's a little microcosm of sort of where we're going.
Mm.
And Texas would be an octagon. And, you know, Oregon and Washington, Seattle, D.C., or, you know, L.A., whatever. These are going to be safe spaces.
Yeah.
And they're going to be in trouble because they're going to say, they make the proclamations, you know, no more grades for schools. And, you know, you're going to have to, anything under $950, a misdemeanor, it's not, and homelessness is not a crime, and all this kind of stuff. And now you will find that that's what you're going to have. Mm. And as long as we do here in California, as long as you're blaming Toyota for getting their catalytic converter stolen, and not blaming the thieves who steal the catalytic converters off the Toyota, then you're going to decline. And that's what we're seeing right now.
Yeah. So this century, you see increasing balkanization within the USA. So red states perhaps getting redder while blue states get bluer.
Yeah. I mean, there are a handful of people who leave the blue states and obviously bring their insane policies with them, but it's not going to be tolerated.
Yeah. I actually, this was like 2 years ago. I met, it was a friend of a friend, someone I just met that day. It was a young woman from California who had moved to Austin, Texas. And I was asking her just about moving to Austin and what she thought of it. And she liked the fact that it was clean. She liked the fact that it was safe. She mentioned a whole bunch of things that are a result of somewhat more conservative government that she liked. But then she was hypercritical of the same conservatism, and she started railing about Republicans and this and that. And I was just like, this is so funny. the lack of awareness here to simultaneously be railing against conservatism and conservative policies whilst also being grateful on a human level for the benefits that they afford you, but the dots not quite connecting in the brain. I thought it was quite an amusing conversation.
Yeah, there's a lot of that amongst those people.
Mm.
And, you know, they want to, I mean, they all wanted to defund the police, but they wanted their own escorts and attaches for security and stuff. It's all just sort of, It's all of it can all be condensed down to sanctuary cities. We're a sanctuary city. Nobody's illegal. No human's illegal. We welcome everyone from all diversities and all lands and all whatever. And as soon as the buses start showing up, they throw their hands up and yell, we're not prepared to deal with this problem.
Yeah,
that's essentially how their politics work. I like the part where I would announce no one's illegal and love is for everyone and we're a sanctuary city. That's all fine, but you have to have I'm all for defund the police and have community ambassadors, but it's got to work.
Yeah.
And it never does.
No, unsurprisingly. A while back, you wrote a book called In 50 Years, We'll All Be Chicks. I hear a lot of talk these days about the crisis of masculinity and the state of the modern man and how much young men are struggling. These are big, increasingly large conversations. Why did you title the book? Why did you give the book that title to begin with?
I sensed something was happening, even though I didn't really know it. I just had a feeling about it. You know, I'm tuned in and I'm pretty well. I do my radar dish faces true north and I do a lot of calculating with it and tuning of it to keep sure that the signal is strong and that I'm picking up what's happening and feeling it, you know, and it's sort of why I did what I did with COVID. It's like very, very early on, just 7 or 8 days into COVID, I was like, something's wrong. They're not giving us ages of people who died. And I think they're all old and they're not telling us that. Mm-hmm. And then why aren't they telling us that? And what are they trying to do by not telling us that? So I was 7, 8 days into COVID. I was like, okay, something's up.
Yeah.
Early. And everyone else was like, put your mask on and go along. You know, and I was like, something's up. I'm not saying everything out loud yet. And I don't know, but I do know something's up.
Yes.
And it's not just this. And I guess 15 years ago, I was feeling that way about this sort of transition and masculinity and where we were heading. And we headed, you know, we got there faster than I'd predicted.
It's more like 15 years.
And yeah, and I, you know, you can name your comedy book anything you want, yes. You know, and this wasn't even, to me, it wasn't the theme of the book per se. The book was a comedy book that had some of these themes in it, but it was a comedy book. And the publishers will always just say, you know, what do you want to name your book? You know, and you know, you come up with stupid word plays and twists on your name and, you know, that kind of stuff. And somehow this landed for me. And I never thought it was particularly clever. I didn't really think it was a play on words, you know, or a turn of phrase. Like I didn't really think it was even that smart. I just felt it was accurate or something. There's something important about it or something. So whatever it is I was feeling was happening, I just couldn't put my finger on it.
Mm-hmm. And now that we're, I don't know, 15, 16 years beyond that, and we are living in a time where some men are quite literally trying to turn into chicks or claiming to be, what do you make of all that?
I mean, I think some of it is environmental. You know, you can only be exposed to so much plastic, you know, before you start messing with your chemistry. And like anything, it's an environment meets a sort of societal mores and, you know, and also a perception of what do women want, because guys are constantly trying to figure that one out, you know, for obvious reasons. So I think it's physical, I mean chemical, to a certain degree, you know, lower testosterone levels, lower sperm count, you know, that's going to help.
Yes.
And then it's also constant bombarding of, and I grew up with this, you know, like if we had a woman president, we'd have no wars, you know what I mean? Like there's a lot of a woman, if we needed a woman. And then you see the commercials and it's the husband's a buffoon and the woman's smart.
There's,
you know?
There's a lot of media messaging and has been for the past several decades in the West, which is that men and women are equal, but women are a little bit better.
A little smarter.
It's subtle, but it's also not that subtle if you consume a lot of traditional media. You see.
Yeah, and it makes sense. Also, there's a, you know, kind of a practical application of you know, if you want to be employed and gainfully employed, you can't make a lot of masculine noises. You know, you can't really, it's not going to be good to really be masculine at work or to let people know, you know, what you think. And just like this little stuff, like, you know, people go like, I would never let my kid play tackle football. It's too dangerous. And then who wants to be the only parent in the room? And I always am going, fuck that. I don't want my kid to be a pussy. Like, let him play football. Like, there becomes a herd mentality. And they start agreeing that the woman's side of the aisle is more evolved.
Yes.
They are evolved. And they think in a better, more evolved way. And we need less and less men. We have loggers anymore. You know what I mean? We have loggers, but we don't need vast numbers of guys who can walk along I-beams and put hot rivets into skyscrapers and stuff. Like, We're breeding them out. Like, yes. We just don't need that. We need people doing coding. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And, you know, working in the gig economy and stuff. We don't need guys with big forearms who can handle pain, you know, taking care of business at a logging camp, you know? So, I mean, I would say it's a lot of forces yeah. that are pushing us a direction that is more feminine and less masculine.
It's so interesting you say that. I've made the exact same observation, and I think it's what is resulting in a lot of the rising safetyism.
Yes.
As I call it. It's not safety, it's almost safety as an ideology.
Yeah.
Safety above everything. Safety above
Uber Alice.
Yes. Safety above liberty. Safety above yes. personal development.
Yes.
Safety above just everything. I call it nerfing the world.
Yes.
Instead of trying to make a child or an individual stronger, you try to remove every threat, every potential insult, every tiny thing that could, I mean, we trigger warnings in safe spaces, right? Anything that could make you even feel slightly uncomfortable or offended, instead of telling you to become more resilient and build yourself up so you can deal with that, it's just, okay, we're just going to X out and cancel and censor and ban all of it down, whether it's a Dr. Seuss book or whatever it is. It's, oh, this person's coming to speak on a college campus. They might say something that some students disagree with, so we're just going to deplatform them and prevent them from even coming. All of this mentality, COVID yes. was the ultimate expression of this,
yes.
where I wouldn't even say safety. I would say the illusion of safety
yes.
and the feeling of safety just superseded everything, including basic human rights.
Yes.
And because of this mentality being so pervasive, a very worrying number of people were okay with it. I mean, I remember when people started mocking the concept of freedom by spelling it, you know, free D-U-M-B.
Oh, really? I didn't
right?
see that.
Yeah, you know, or even one of my personal childhood heroes, Arnold Schwarzenegger. I don't mean to call him out, but man, when he came out and said, you know, screw your freedom. Man, I don't often have my heart broken by celebrities because I'm not that invested, but I was like, man, I was like, this guy my whole life, like this
totally
is like the king of masculinity.
I lost a lot of respect for him, and it was, especially like, coming from where he comes
exactly,
from.
Exactly. I was just like, how, man, you know, like if you want to wear your mask or you want to do it, like, cool, like you do you. But it was it's not enough for me to do it. Everybody else must do the same.
I agree. And it's, you know, I think a lot of this stuff is in the name of progress, you know, and, you know, and there are things like the progressive movement. It's got the word progress and movement in the title. So people go, when does it end? Where do they stop? I go, check the title, progress and movement. Is there any part of those two words that suggest pumping the brakes, yeah. you know? And I've said this a million times, like just because it's a new idea doesn't mean it's a good idea. You know, the Greeks knew about diet and exercise. Mm. All right. It's still a good idea. do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's diet and exercise. There is no way you can have the Weight Watchers fudge brownie, you know, dessert, but it doesn't work. And so not every idea is progress. Mm-hmm. It's just a lot of it's different. And it's not different in a good way. And they're trying to steer us into this feminine sort of morass that somehow seems like progress. And again, I'm with you. The you know, rounding over every sharp edge and putting a helmet on every kid, it's not good. And it has – there's no free lunches in nature. You're not allowed to do all this and not expect something to come out of it that you didn't anticipate mm-hmm. and that you don't want and that does not benefit society. Mm. You know, we were meant to be different, and that was a good thing. I would handle the thatching of the roof and you bake the bread, or you go down to the river and clean the clothes and I'll hunt, you know, or whatever it is we got to do. We don't want two people at the river cleaning the clothes, and we don't want two people baking the bread. Somebody's got to go shoot a deer, and the other has to cook the deer.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't want two shooting the deer and no one cooking the deer. This diversity, it's good.
Yes.
It's a good thing. It's good that you have baked in stuff with women and baked in stuff with men. And somehow we're trying to leech out all of the male qualities, and we need those male qualities in men. And I'll warn women first and foremost, you don't want this.
Yes. Women complain about it.
They complain about it all the time. Yes. Now, because yes, when there's a bump in the night and you're both laying in bed, you don't want to play rock, paper, scissors to see who's going downstairs. Mm. That's what the guy should be doing.
Yeah. It's I've never used this term before, but it's this like gender homogenization.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Until stuff hits the fan.
Yes.
And then it very quickly reverts back to, you know, women and children first, men go out and, you know, go out and deal with the problems. Adam, I love your work, man. Massively inspired by it. I love hearing your story of the progress made over the decades. I think there's so many subtle lessons that people can learn from that about perseverance and about personal responsibility, accountability, and not playing victim and not expecting magical things to just happen to you because you breathe air. And I hope that message resonates with a lot of people listening. Is there anything that you have got coming up this year or you've currently got out that you want people to know about?
Always got stuff coming out and there's always stuff going on. And if you go to adamcarolla.com, you could probably find out anything that might be coming up or coming to a town near you.
Awesome. Adam, thanks for your time, man. Great to chat to you.
Thanks, Zuby.